Welcome to Comics,
episode 232. This week, we talk about
comic book art.
Visit us at welcometocomics.com. Listen to past episodes, see what we're reading next, send us a message, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. This episode is supported by listeners like you. Go to patreon.com/welcometocomics. And now,
the cast review.
Ready to talk about? I don't know. I don't have any witty banter. I was about to launch into some witty banter, but there's nothing in the notes. I don't have anything.
Well, so last week was here in San Jose was Wizard World.
Oh yeah.
And I did not go.
Oh, you didn't go?
Oh. I couldn't. I had trouble making time. So.
Yeah.
You know, parenting and stuff.
Yeah, that happens.
But I'm glad it happened. Because, you know, it's important. I think it's good for our area to get these kinds of, these kinds of things because then more will come.
Yeah, you know, we're one of the major metropolitan areas in the country and we don't have a comic book convention.
Well,
like a stable one year to year.
Well, we had Big Wow for like 3 years and Big Wow's being supplanted by, by Wizard World, which is fine because Wizard World is a bigger name
in comics and conventions and all. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's good for us. I kind of feel bad because Big Wow is doing such a good job of building its own momentum, and I feel like it's going to lose it just because this other bigger player comes to town. It's like all their hard work just gone.
Well, it's not, I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens, right? I mean,
people
start a company and then it gets bought by, you know.
Did they get bought or did they just get supplanted?
I don't know. I thought they were like partnering up or something like that.
Yeah, there was a big one this year. There's nothing on their website.
I don't know.
I'll be interested in finding out about that, because I really did like Big Wow as a show, and I like how they kept building year over year over year.
I mean, it was okay. I didn't go to any panels when I went to Big Wow, so I don't know what the quality was there. I mean, they got Stan Lee to appear last year.
Yeah.
Right? So that's something.
Yeah. That is something.
I think the problem with conventions... And it's not actually the convention's fault. It's that San Diego Comic-Con is the gold standard. So people always, I think, when I say people, I mean the general populace who are not necessarily familiar with conventions outside of what they hear about from places like Comic-Con probably have skewed expectations.
Yeah.
Fortunately, in this area, we get other conventions like Fanime, which tends to draw the typical convention crowd.
yeah.
Well, I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean there's people there who know what a convention is really about, and that San Diego Comic-Con is more the exception than the norm. I mean the ones that get press are the big ones, right?
Yeah.
So San Diego Comic-Con.
C2E2, New York.
Yeah.
Emerald City.
Even Emerald City, I think, doesn't get as much. It's smaller than San Diego.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. And we're kind of, like, in the Bay Area, we're in a weird place right now because we had Big Wow, we have Wizard World San Jose, and last year Steve Wozniak announced that he was doing Silicon Valley Comic Con, and that's still going to happen in March of next year.
Oh, see, I thought Wizard World was that.
No, so Steve Wozniak's still doing his Comic Con in March.
Oh, so that, okay, so I think Silicon Valley Comic Con is the one.
I think that's what happened to Big Wow.
Big Wow, yeah.
I think they rolled together.
Okay. So Wizard World is a brand new thing. Well, it's not new, but it's new to this area. Okay. Yeah. That's why I was kind of confused.
Yeah, Wizard World. Well, there's the company that does San Diego Comic-Con, and they do SDCC and WonderCon. Those are the two big ones. And they also do Alternative Press Expo, which is way, way smaller, but it has its niche. And then I think the next largest would be Read Pop. They specialize in large conventions, so like
they did
Star Wars Celebration, and they did an excellent job at that. I hear good things about... They bought Emerald City Comic Con, and I hear good things about that since they've bought it. And they seem to really be into running these large conventions. And Wizard World does kind of the, I don't want to call it mop-up work because it sounds menial, but like if you're in a mid-sized metropolitan area that doesn't have a comic book convention, odds are you've got a Wizard World near you. If you're in Minneapolis, if you're St. Paul, those are the same city almost. If you're a St. Louis, if you're a Kansas City, odds are you get a Wizard World. And that's what we got, Wizard World. But I feel like we deserve so much bigger. We're fucking the Bay Area. Like, I don't care if it's Oakland or, I don't know. There's a bunch of smaller conventions here, but none of them have really emerged as, like, the big one for the area.
Well, I think the thing was, we've always had conventions.
Yeah.
But conventions, as a form of entertainment, have really gotten big since... Mm-hmm. Since the internet has allowed huge coverage for things like San Diego Comic Con, because news channels and stuff are not going to commit many cycles to covering a comic convention on TV. But on the internet, you know, sky's the limit, right?
Yeah.
So now that they're becoming more popular, I think that the people who run conventions are seeing the opportunity to make more money by creating more. San Diego Comic Con will probably always be the, you know, like I said, the gold standard, the biggest one. But the thing is, you know, I think SDCC will keep that name, but the thing is, it's not so much about the comics anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing you hear a lot about San Diego Comic Con.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing necessarily.
No.
But maybe as San Diego becomes more of a pop culture convention, it'll increase the opportunity cost for other conventions to, not opportunity cost, but it'll give them the better opportunity to take advantage of this, like, missing this void, right? So people can, or other conventions can pick up the slack.
Yeah, they can carve the niche that I mean, this is the thing with comic book conventions. Some of them are known for a lot of different things. Like, you can listen to our convention episode for more information about this, like more in-depth discussion. But like, some are known for having a good artist alley. Some are known for having good, like, autograph area. Some are known for good vendors. Some are known for good panels. And like, some of them are really specialized in it. Like, if you want the best cosplay, you go to Dragon Con. If you want to meet celebrities one-on-one at an affordable price with small lines, you go to Emerald City or Phoenix. If you want, I don't know, like just that kind of example, but you have to go to like five or six different conventions. What makes San Diego Comic-Con so popular is that all of those are there. It might not be, bar none, the best cosplay, but it's the second best cosplay. It might not be the best chance to meet celebrities, but it has the most celebrities. And it's probably the second best. Like, I can't remember. There was the name of some philosopher in ancient Greece, and they called him Beta. Because he was not the alpha in anything. He was not the first or the best, but he was second best at everything he tried. Which, like, seems kind of like an insult, like you're second best. But he was second best at everything. Sure, he wasn't the best at anything, but everything he was second best. Which made him a really fucking awesome dude. And that's kind of where San Diego Comic-Con is. It's not the singularly best experience for almost anything, but it is the second or third best at everything. Which, like, it. So then, if whatever you want to go to a convention for, you'll find it at San Diego Comic-Con, which is what makes it such a mecca. Because everybody can find what they're looking for if they go. Except for Peace and Shortlines.
Yep.
So do I do a this week's comic drop? I don't know. We're not doing a comic this week.
We're not talking about a single comic.
No, this week we're talking about comic book art. Because a couple weeks ago, somebody sent us a message or posted somewhere. I don't remember exactly how I got the feedback, but somebody told us that they really wanted another episode, like our convention episode, where we talk about stuff just in a general kind of way and sort of introduce the idea of a topic to somebody who's maybe not familiar. So we decided to talk about talking about comic book art, because we throw around terms a lot on the show, like acting, flow, movement, splash pages, gutters, panel work. And if you don't know what we're talking about, or if you're just not familiar with talking about that kind of stuff, this is a good primer for you to catch up on those sorts of things. And I'm kind of excited about this, because we haven't, the three of us haven't sat down and talked about what we thought about comic book art before, have we? Maybe like episode one.
When we were like first getting to know each other.
Yeah.
It's not an easy topic to talk about in an audio format.
Yeah.
But somehow we managed to do it.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. So, just, we're going to go over really general stuff. There's a section of terms called the lexicon, which covers really specific tricks of comic book art. Not like action lines are really general, but there's a certain kind of action line that has a special name. There's these things called, like a good example would be a dite. D-I-T-E. A dite is like if somebody's looking at a thing and like, oh my god! And when they're looking at it and you wanna get that point across, so you have like a thing like popping out of the side of the person's head, that's a dite. We're not gonna get that granular. So we're gonna talk about, I don't know, this is weird. Do we just like, I don't want to just define terms. You know?
Okay.
So I don't know. How about we start it by of all of the things that we've read, we all have a big list of some of the favorite art that we've come across. What do you think is your favorite artist or your favorite instance of art in everything that we've read so far, and what makes it your favorite? How about we start there? Jen, how about you go first?
Everything that we have read.
Your singular favorite. Man, you must pick one
singular
child.
Singular favorite. Okay.
Okay, you don't have to pick a singular favorite. Pick a good starting point.
A good starting point. Okay. Yeah. I'd say Tim Sale in The Long Halloween.
That's a good one.
His work is so evocative of Batman and Gotham, even if it had not been a story about Batman.
Batman.
This is like Batman. The third week in a row I've screwed up Batman's name.
I'm imagining the captain from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh god, yeah. So even if it had not been a comic about The Dark Knight, it still would have evoked that feeling, the darkness, the grittiness, the kind of like 1920s detective setting. I just feel like that was one of the comics we read very, very early on, actually. That was like one of the first things we read, I think, where the art and the story were just so perfectly intertwined that it really made for just a really enjoyable read.
Yeah, and actually Jen, that's a perfect choice. So we can talk about the highlight of Long Halloween. Tim Sale's pencil work is great, but I think the real highlight of Long Halloween, I don't know if he did the inking for that or not, but we'll talk about, so when a comic book is made, way back in the day, it was kind of like a factory line almost, if you think of it this way. One person would sit down with a big sheet of paper in front of them and draw things out with a pencil. The second person would then go over those pencil lines with ink and add a little bit of shadows with the ink, add some lines here or there with the ink to try and accent what the penciler was trying to do. The inker would then hand it off to a colorist who would fill in color. So this is this color, that's that color. And their job was just to put color in between the lines. And then they would hand it to the letterer, who's the person who puts in the word bubbles and the text, chooses the font, chooses where the word bubbles go, all that kind of stuff. And the thing about Long Halloween is it was a really, really great use of negative space, which is when there's not color, there's not art, there's not anything happening, there's just a big black shadow or a big black purple background, just hard colors with nothing in them. And that feeling, and when you feel like you have deep shadows like that, and it's just, there's nothing there, that's super Batman, like that shadowed world. It did a great job of setting the tone, that ink work and that.
Yeah, and it was just something about it. Like, it, the ink work led to a real cleanliness of shape. I think a lot of the stuff was really angular, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. There's just something about the power of a strong silhouette that works really well for a dark nighttime setting. And it's the idea that you're not looking at all the little details. You don't get to see what Batman sees. You're seeing kind of like a bigger picture. And I mean, the details of the city are obscure to you. I think that idea works really well for a mystery. There's just something, I don't know. It's a nice metaphor in my mind.
Well, and I think it's core to Batman's character in a lot of ways, or at least his character design. Like, okay, this is going to get super, super too deep. But when you think about his logo, right, his original logo, which was the yellow circle with the black outline of the bat, there's so much of Batman in his character design that's all about the silhouette. And the other thing I think about when I think about Batman is the animated series, when he is just, like, standing there and his cape is all the way around him, and it's just, like, him as just, like, a black tower. And the cowl comes up out of that, and the only thing that isn't black is his face, and it's all just flat black. Like, that washing out, that just making him, like, the Dark Knight, making him part of the shadow in so many places, works so awesome. Which then, David, don't you have animated stuff on yours?
Yeah, I put Bruce Timm down on mine because, I think, to me, one of the biggest ways that, like, that I've experienced DC was through Bruce Timm's work on, you know, Batman the Animated Series, Justice League, Justice League Unlimited, Batman Beyond. There, he has, his art totally informed the DC universe for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And even the same work translated into comics, and you know, that's very much, it's cartoony, right? I hate to say cartoony because it is a cartoon, but the people have exaggerated proportions, like the large shoulders and the tape, they kind of taper as they go down to the feet, but not so much like it's a Rob Liefeld, X-Force type of foot. it's hard to describe that. You know that. Well, what was interesting about Bruce Timm's art in the different shows he worked on is that it worked in different. The art style worked in different settings because my first experience with Bruce Timm was Batman the Animated Series, where, like you said, Andy, there's lots of silhouettes, and the show was drawn on a black background.
Yeah, it's drawn on black paper.
Yeah, but the same exact art style is used for Justice League Unlimited, which has a huge amount of different scenes. Or, you know, I totally forgot. Superman.
Yeah.
Superman animated series is the exact opposite. Superman is out in the super daytime. Bright. Metropolis is
the shining city.
Yeah, it's completely different from Gotham. And this art style works really well in both. And I don't know what I just really like that style, which is why I also have Darwin Cook's DC New Frontier on here on my list, is because it kind of harkens back to kind of Golden Age type of style. I mean, not all the Golden Age comics were drawn in this style, and but it's got some, you know. it's got some, like, God, I hate trying to talk about a visual thing. It's definitely informed by, you know, people like, God, why can't I think of what his name is? Jack Kirby. There we go. And, you know, and Darwin Cook even worked on Batman and Superman. And he did some work on Batman Beyond too. So it's not a big surprise that I like both Darwin Cook and Bruce Timm, because they're very, very close together. And it's hard for me to think of other artists who did a similar style. I mean, Mike Mignola's is kind of the same.
Yeah.
Like the kind of blocky,
the triangular, it's the triangular upper body almost. With the tiny point being down at the waist and the broad, broad shoulders. It's a very triangular chest with a almost square shaped head for most characters.
Yeah. And I mean, Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent in, the buffest DC
motherfuckers
animated,
you've ever seen.
They look almost the same.
Yeah.
And the way, it's like their eyes are what tells you who's who.
Yeah.
Well, and plus.
A cow.
You know, the cat. Well, this, not, well, I mean, when they're out of costume.
Oh, yeah. The glasses, then.
The glasses, and Bruce Wayne is all, see, kind of scowling.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, I really like their art style. It's, to me, it's kind of, well, it's got an Art Deco feel.
Yeah,
which is really
super
appropriate for DC, for New Frontier, and for Batman the Animated Series, because the setting is very much like the 1930s, you know. Even though it's really not tied to any particular time, it just kind of informs the audience about the atmosphere, I guess. And it also, especially with New Frontier, there's kind of a bit of like innocence in the art, as opposed to more realistic comics. So
yeah,
I just rambled for a long time.
So. No, you're right about the innocence, and I think it's because both Darwin Cook and did we read DC New Frontier or watch it? Did we watch the TV movie, didn't we? Is that what we did?
I don't think we did. I don't think we've talked about New Frontier.
No, I don't think so. Sure.
Anyway, Darwin Cook did that. Darwin Cook's done a bunch of other good stuff. And the same is true, what I'm about to say, for Bruce Timm's art is... Fuck, I just lost what I was going to say. Is that they don't... they use an older style to their advantage. So, way back in the day, when you would print on older paper, you would print for speed... The paper quality was lower because the print cost was cheaper and the ink was cheaper. So you couldn't have the kind of sharpness to lines that you have now. So you had to really make sure that things were clear. Lines had to be hard. They had to be separated. They had to be clear. So, for example, in Bruce Timm and Darwin Cook's art style, when you draw the eye, it's just a circle. Or... you cheat even a little bit more, and when you put the cowl on Bruce Wayne, you just have the eyes be part of the cowl, and you make those cheaty little things that you don't notice when you're watching because your mind kind of fills in those gaps in the art. But if you look at them, in neither Darwin Cook nor Bruce Timm's art do they look like people. They really don't. Look at their hands and the way the hands move. Are there individual fingers? Can you see the knuckles? Because if you read a lot of modern comics and you see a scene of somebody punching another person, they might have drawn in knuckles. That level of detail didn't exist back then. So for people who learned that kind of art from that style, you can tell that it's not that they're not good enough to draw those things. Bruce Timm is insanely talented. Darwin Cook is insanely talented. It's that they came from an era when those things were not important to draw. The important thing to draw was what got the story moving forward. Because you as the reader, you can fill in the gap visually. You can know, all right, there's a fist there. I know there's five fingers and the knuckles and everything. I don't have to see them. I just have to see the fist, and then I'll get it. Okay. But that also, that frees up so much as an artist so that you can do other things. You can have more time to pay attention to details like Art Deco architecture in one city versus Gothic architecture in another. You can build those backgrounds to provide feeling and vibe and all that kind of stuff in the details in the background because you're not focusing so much on the characters. And I feel like that's another thing that's more classic is the feeling of the backgrounds. Backgrounds used to be so much more important. Which we could go a couple different ways from there. We can talk about like super detailed backgrounds, like Amanda Connor who likes to hide jokes in the background, or we could go the other way and find a person like Mike Mignola, who does Hellboy, who doesn't put in backgrounds. He doesn't feel like backgrounds are important. If you read Mike Mignola, half of the panels, half of the pages just have flat color in the back. There's no buildings or anything. It's just a dude punching another dude on a yellow background or a bright red background. I don't know, it's just kind of a personal choice kind of thing. But I think that's why Bruce Timm and Darwin Cook look and have that feel. What I find interesting is Phil Noto also feels super retro to me. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't do that. His stuff is super detailed. And I've been trying to figure out. Phil Noto, we read Creator Owned Heroes, which was Jimmy Palmiotti's like comic book magazine thing he was trying to get going a couple of years ago. And Phil Noto did a section, and it was Trigger Girl was the section that Phil Noto had done. And I don't know what about Phil Noto just has this great retro vibe to it. I can't put my finger on it, but I love it.
I have a theory.
Yeah?
So after we read that, I started regularly checking in on Phil Noto's Tumblr because it's really good and he posts his art pretty regularly. And a while ago, he had this art book called Jet 7. And it's mostly just, you know, like his art of whatever, like I think like his work for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it has this really wonderfully like mod 60s and 70s vibe, I feel. Like it almost reminds me of advertisement illustrations from the 70s. You know, the ladies all have like really like that long, like 70s hair. I think there's more retro vibes in how some of them are dressed.
He usually does choose the older versions of costumes when he draws characters.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if maybe that's the era that you kind of see in his work coming out. Maybe something like more mod than, you know, golden or silver comics stuff, but almost like pop cultural.
I think you're right. When you talk about advertising art, that's like, that's spot on. And scrolling through some of myself, he plays a lot with coloring and, using color to make negative space. Like when he draws a person wearing headphones to get the white, he just won't draw the headphones. He'll let that be the white paper coming through. So it's this stark contrasting color that gives it that kind of retro feel that like, the too white to be real that you would see in old advertising, back when advertising was hand-drawn. Man, now I can't get the advertising thing out of my head, Jen.
You'll see it every time you see one of his covers from now on.
Yeah, probably now. Actually, I've been picking up, he's been doing Black Widow. I've been picking that up, and it's, oh my god, the art in there is phenomenal. It's just, it's so beautiful. Every page is gorgeous. It's gorgeous. So, David, what was your favorite, your favorite art out of everything that we've read?
That's, you know, it's not easy to say because it's hard for me to separate the art from the other pieces that make up a comic.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, if I look at what I wrote on my list, it's kind of all over the place. And I even put some things on that we didn't read. But, you know, Alex Ross, I put him down for two different comics. I put down Kingdom Come and Project Superpowers, which were, I think he only did the covers for Project Superpowers, but the covers really, stuck with me. Alex Ross's style is, it's so, it's hard to describe. It's like, it's, it's realistic, I think.
There's a lot of, it feels like it's painted, like every page is painted on a canvas with a brush.
It's very shiny.
Yes.
But then it also has soft edges. Like, I keep thinking of in Kingdom Come where Clark is on the farm after he's, like, retired and gone back to Smallville to be a farmer.
Yeah.
And, you know, Superman is this imposing figure, but the sun's behind him, and the light from the sun kind of washes the edges of him away, and he's kind of like part of, he's like coming out of the light. And like you said, Andy, it's just when I'm describing this, I'm not meaning to say this to demean other artists or put down or say that Alex Ross's work is better, but it's beautiful in its own kind of way. It's like a Norman Rockwell painting, you know.
Ah, there you go. That's a good analogy.
It's like classic Americana for some. It's kind of what I think of it when I think of Alex Ross, and whenever I see an Alex Ross piece, it's instantaneous recognition.
Oh yeah, there's not many other people that have a style like he does.
And so, it's hard to pick a favorite. I'm gonna go with Alex Ross because it stands out to me. It stands out so much, and like the covers he did for Project Superpowers, particularly the covers for the Black Terror, like spinoffs. The skull and crossbones on Black Terror's costume on the chest. I remember one of the covers. It's like, you know, the whole cover is like bright, but the Jolly Roger on his chest is like glowing. It's hard. I don't know how else to describe it. It looks like it's glowing.
It's like if you, it's like if you're sitting in a super bright room and you have a thing on your shirt that's sewn on and it's bright white and it's almost reflective and it's kind of shiny in the light. It's like that. Just kind of like reflective material on his thing that you can see the glow coming off of it.
Yeah.
But it's not that the crossbones themselves are glowing. It's the warmth of reflected light,
mm-hmm.
which is such an elusive thing to try and capture, especially in comic book art. But I think what really defines Alex Ross for me, aside from the stuff you talked about, is the depth of his color palette. I mean, when we talk about Bruce Timm and Darwin Cook, and I mentioned Mike Mignola, their coloring is all super, super flat. There's not a lot of, if Mike Mignola is going to use yellow on a page, he's going to use one shade of yellow. He's not going to use five shades of yellow. He's not going to use that. Alex Ross will use 20 different shades of flesh on Superman's face just to make it perfect, you know? And it creates a lot of depth that really gives it that ultra-realistic feel while still coming off as just, like, a beautiful painting. It's a great dichotomy, and it's part of what makes Alex Ross's, full pages really, really good, which is another thing we can talk about when we talk about comic book art is these full pages. So there's two different kinds. There's one that's called splash pages. That's when it takes up one whole singular page, and then there's a spread. It can be a two-page spread. Lately, people have been playing around, they're trying like a fold out, like third page for a third page spread. I don't know. Those kinds of things are gimmicky, I think. But usually when you talk about a splash page, it's one big singular page, and two pages, it'll be a spread. And Alex Ross's full pages, man, they're great. The perfect way to execute a splash page, is when you'll go from one page and you'll have lots of little panels. So like the box that confines a window of art is called a panel. So there'd be lots of little panels. This is the way you do it classically. And then when you turn the page, after you turn the page, you come to a spread so that you're focusing in, you're looking at these small panels, you're looking at the smaller details, and then you turn the page, and the big splash page gives you this feeling of, whoa! It comes out at you because not only is the thing on it have room to be bigger and drawn more detailed, but the image on the page, like, it's... There's a singular panel. Your vision has to adjust to take in the whole page after the small panels. And it can create a really striking effect. And I think my favorite splash page I've ever read was also, I don't know if you're going to, you might think of this one, David, is also a page out of Kingdom Come by Alex Ross. And it's the page where they're fighting at the end and fucking Shazam shows up.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
And, like...
He's got his arms crossed and stuff.
Yeah, he's got his arms... I don't know if they're crossed. I don't remember if they're crossed or if they're, like, on his hips. I think they're on his hips. He's just, like, in the classic superhero pose.
Yeah, they're on his hips. You're right.
But he's still under... He's still under Lex Luthor's mind. Yeah, he's towering over Superman, who is just, like, hunched over because he's gotten beat up so bad. And the face on Shazam is priceless because the pose is the superhero pose of strength, like, haha, like the Wonder Woman pose, you know? Except his face, he's still under Lex Luthor's mind control. It's maniacal and evil and terrible. And the clouds behind him are stormy. And coming from the smaller panels you turn to this, it's just boom. Shazam looks larger than life, and it amplifies the effect to have Superman down in the corner, like hunched over, beaten, and Shazam standing there with that look on his face, and you can take in the whole of the scene behind him and the atmosphere, and that's the effect you really, really want when you make a splash page. That's like the epitome for a splash page. I don't know if it would be the opposite of that, but the spread. So the splash page is one big one. You can do the same thing with the spread, but you got to be super luxurious, because then you're taking... How long is a comic nowadays? 26 pages, I want to say? 24?
It's 22.
22?
23, I think. They've gotten shorter. Yeah.
So if you're going to do one... If you're going to do a spread, and you're going to have it be a singular image, then you're taking a tenth of the entire comic, the tenth of your entire storytelling power, and putting it in one page, basically, when you do a two-page spread, because that's when it covers both pages of the comic when you lay it out flat. And that, you got to be careful with that, because it can really amplify it, the strength of the thing, but at the same time, it feels really, what's the word, like, luxurious to have to do that. I think a much better use of a spread is when you fill it up with panels. Not panels, but when you create a flow across it. So my favorite example of this, because it's really hard to talk about, you're right, is J.H. Williams III with Batwoman Eulogy. J.H. Williams III, he does amazing panel work, in that he doesn't really do panels. He basically says, fuck panels, and just draws whatever the hell he wants, and then draws lines around that. I don't know. It's really hard to describe. J.H. Williams III...
Yeah, he doesn't stick to rectangles. He goes with, like, really organic shapes. But then you can still tell, like, the flow of the narrative from square to square to square. Huh? They're not squares, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm going to stay on the spread because I can gush about J.H. Williams III for a while in his panel work. But I really remember one of the spreads that sticks out in my mind is from Batwoman Eulogy, and it's a fight scene. And across the two-page spread, boom, big, is the bat symbol. And the bat symbol's cut up into, like, five different sections. And each section is a different punch or kick in the fight scene. And all around this bat symbol in this two-page spread is other bits of fighting and a little bit of text here and there. And that way, J.H. Williams III is activating both of those pages to tell a story. And he's saying, this is the fight scene, this is how she's punching this guy here, that guy there. And it still has this, it has a connected flow to it, but it's also wild and all over the place. Just like a fight scene would, just like a fight would be, like if you were fucking Batwoman in a fight. You'd just be turning and punching whatever was next to you. Because fuck, bad guys, right? But it's beautiful, it activates both of those pages, and it's a really, really great use of a two-page spread. Do either of you guys have like a spread or a splash page that you remember that, like, just stuck out with you?
Oh, man.
It's hard to mention. It's hard to think of people who haven't mentioned before. Like, I'm thinking of Mike Mignola, who started out drawing covers, which are basically full-page spreads. So if you read a Mike Mignola comic, it's just, like, splash after splash after splash.
Well, it's from Walt Simonson's Thor. It's the... it's the Doom page where Surtur like working on the anvil on his sword, I think. It's a splash page. It is a splash page.
Yeah.
It's an anvil and a hammer hitting the anvil. But it's supposed to be like on a cosmic scale, so there's planets in the background, and there's a silhouette of some evil creature, and the colors, there's reds and orange, white, purple, blue. And then he did the lettering for it too, at least on this page, and he wrote Doom in huge letters. And it's just that, you know, that splash page. There's another one. He does this a couple times. There's another one later in the run with where it's Surtur standing over his legions of demons. And, you know, it says Doom at the bottom of the page again. But this one it's this, like, infinite number of demon soldiers and Surtur all orange and giant and with a huge sword. It's just awesome. Like, so I could go on and on about Walt Simonson.
You and me both.
He's been around for such a long time, and his work is always excellent.
I think what makes Walt Simonson's work Walt Simonson, I think, has been on a next level for so long. And as much as we've loved his Thor run that he drew and wrote both himself, mm-hmm. I really liked Orion, Gates of Apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a fantastic story. The first volume is 5 issues long. The first 4 issues, you could kind of give or take. But that there's a 5th issue in that.
Yeah, that one's, I know, the one where he fights Darkseid.
It's Orion, yeah. Orion and Darkseid are fighting. And this is another thing that's really important when you think about comic book art, is action and acting. So when you talk about acting in comics and in art in general, you're talking about how you visualize people moving in a space. So if you're showing, it could be anything. It could be a fight scene, or it could be people walking around in a conference room. But the artist needs to draw the panels in an order and draw the people placement in an order consistently so that they're not always standing in the same place. They're able to move around in the space, but they don't never move around so far that the reader isn't able to fill the space between the panels. The space between the panels is called the gutter. Sometimes there's a hard gutter like those white lines that you notice, but just colloquially it's called the gutters. So the reader has to fill in the gutters, the space between the panels, as people are moving through a space. And I think that's one of the things that Walt Simonson does the absolute best. And the best example of that is that 5th issue of Orion, Gates of Apocalypse, because Orion and Darkseid have been arguing back and forth about whether they're similar. Apocalypse says, Orion, you're just like... Or Darkseid says, Orion, you're just like me. I'm your father. Orion says, fuck you, I'm a good guy. And it all culminates into this 5th issue where it's a fight scene. And that thing is just... Man, if you don't think fight scenes are relevant for comics, or you find that to be the boring part of a comic, you need to read that 5th issue, like, right now. Like, whoa. Because it's amazing. Like, whoa.
Yeah.
Because not only do the two of them move through the space in the way that you can completely go page to page, he activates every part of every page, and there's almost no words in the entire comic, but he's able to get the story across. In the beginning, Darkseid is vicious and Orion is not. But by the end, to win, Orion becomes vicious in the fight. And Orion becomes just like his father. And you see that Darkseid is right. He is. And it's terrible. But God, just to get all of that... That issue is the culmination of the story. Like, can you imagine reading an 8-issue or even a 5 or 6-issue trade and have the last issue, have the culmination, the finality of that storyline, not have hardly any words? You have to be real good with your acting and your action. And Walt Simonson is real good.
Man, that totally reminded me of someone that totally should be on my list. And that's Larry Hama.
What did he do?
He is the guy who did G.I. Joe for like... He did 150 issues of G.I. Joe. And I want to make sure that... I don't remember if he actually did the art for it. Yeah, he did. So there's an issue of G.I. Joe. It's number 21 from the original Marvel run. It's called Silent Interlude. And there is no dialogue or word bubbles in the entire comic. No narration, no nothing. It's all conveyed through the art, and it's about Snake Eyes infiltrating Cobra's castle to rescue Scarlet. And then it has Storm Shadow in it too. But man, that is a great example of using art to convey the story, because there's no words at all. You just follow the action, and it's really, really cool. If you've never read that issue, if you've never read an issue of G.I. Joe, and you're only going to read one, read issue 21 of Larry Hama's run.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more than just the art, it's just an amazing comic issue. The thing, maybe this is a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, G.I. Joe, is known for the action figures and the cartoon mostly, I think in most people. But the Marvel run on G.I. Joe is so good. Seriously, you guys.
We should read that shit.
IDW started, you know, IDW does G.I. Joe now, and they, I guess they bought it all from Marvel, so they've been publishing it in really nice large volumes. And they're like 10 issue collections. There's like 15 because the Marvel run was 150 something issues, all done by Larry Hama. And I have like the first six or something. It's great. It's nothing like the cartoon. It's people die, and it's you know.
Yeah,
it's
things you can't do on Sunday morning cartoons.
It's a war. It's about war, you know. Like special forces soldiers and stuff. I mean, it's got Cobra Commander and Destro and things like that, but they're pretty brutal in the comic. So, yeah, that's my plug for G.I. Joe.
So, okay. After all this discussion, I don't know if I can pick a singular favorite, which is cheating because I asked you guys to do that. But I think what we can really come down to is that art can be really good, but in all of these things that we've talked about, the story was pretty good too. Right? I don't think any of the ones that we've chosen had good art and shitty story. Like, I'm going down my list, and all of them were amazingly good reads and had great story. And I'm going down your guys' as well, and it's the same thing. So I think what we have to really realize is that, and anybody who's listening to this show, the quality of the art isn't just how good do you draw. It's how well do you complement the story for which you're writing. Which, Jen, I'm so glad that you did Tim Sale's Long Halloween in the beginning, because Long Halloween is a detective noir story set in the Batman world. And for a detective noir story, you want somebody who draws deep, deep shadows and dark, heavy lines, because that's what a noir feels like. You know, like, it feels like black and white 50s, you know, like Dick Tracy is black and, like, it has that old school feel to it brought into comics. And I don't know, all of these just have that same, that the things that match, especially Darwin Cook and DC New Frontier, Alex Ross and Project Superpowers. And for mine, you're going to laugh, maybe. Probably. I'm pretty sure my favorite is Amanda Connor's Power Girl. Not just because boobs.
Not even going to laugh because I'm not surprised at all.
This is not coming out of left field.
No. But Amanda Connor is really, really good at drawing playfully. You can read The Pro. That's another good example of Amanda Connor's art. Like, what is it?
That's pretty hilarious.
There's like one like 2-page long panel at the end where it's just all the hookers lining up to beat the dude with different things.
Yeah.
And just the details of the different things. And that same kind of feeling is in Amanda Connor's Power Girl. Like, okay, yes, Power Girl boobs, of course Andy's gonna like it. But one of the favorite scenes that I remember is when Power Girl and Tara are going out to watch a scary movie, and some fucking teenagers go up and make fun of her or something. I don't know, and she just talks them the fuck down. And just stuff like that, funny expressions in the background, funny details here and there. It's the ability for the artist to interact with the story that's being told, the tone of the story that's being told, and whether or not they're a good match. And sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're not a good match. I don't have an example of that offhand in my head. I know we did just read one that was a weird match for me. But a more serious answer I could say would be Emma Rios is Pretty Deadly, which I think would be on all of our lists. Emma Rios, Pretty Deadly by Kelly Sue DeConnick was the author there. And I don't know anything about any of Emma Rios' other work. All I read was Pretty Deadly. But Emma Rios does a really, really good job of matching the, like, weird Western tone of Pretty Deadly. And Kelly Sue DeConnick, I've been to a meet and greet Q&A kind of thing with her. And she said that Emma Rios is perfect for that story because Emma Rios puts in details that Kelly Sue DeConnick didn't ask her to put in. She just knew that it needed to be there. Like, we were talking, I think David and I, you were talking about how there's some bird in the corner of the page, which is a shrike, which is mentioned here because it's this other character and their animals, the spirit, and this, that, and the other thing. And
I don't remember that.
I remember that part of our discussion because when I was at this Q&A, Kelly Sue DeConnick was like, I didn't tell her to put that there, but it's perfect. It's beautiful. It needed to be there. It's detailed. It's on the side of a page that nobody's going to notice, probably. And they're not going to know it's a shrike. But for the few people who notice, it's a detail that matters. And I think you find a good piece of comic book art because they're a good fit for the story. They match it. And David, there's one on your list that's the same. It's Justice League International.
Oh, man. Jeez. Kevin Maguire. I still haven't put my Blue Beetle picture I got from him.
Oh, you need to.
But man, he is the master of facial expressions. Seriously. Like, there's a gold standard in having comic book characters express their feelings through their face. Kevin Maguire should have, like, a seminar on it for everybody else. Because that guy has raised it. He has elevated that.
You know,
something
okay.
Further than art form.
You know that face you make when somebody tells you something that you couldn't give a shit about and you think is dumb? And so you make, like, the jerk-off motion with your hand and you make the face that goes with it? Mm-hmm. Kevin Maguire does that face. Nobody else in comics does that face. It seems like such a weird thing to praise, but well, Kevin Maguire nails that face.
And he does it so well in characters that are wearing, like, goggles and a cowl, and they have all this stuff on their face because they're superheroes and they wear crazy costumes, and he could still do it so well, you know? I mean, Ted Kord, man. Kevin Maguire draws my Ted Kord.
Which is also, I think it's perfect for Justice League International because Kevin Maguire and J.M. DeMatteis set out to do that comic because they wanted like a sitcom. They wanted like a superhero sitcom. Like, what is it like when you're not saving the world? And what is it like when you're not saving the world is apparently half of these people are jackasses. And they just sit around talking about shit that the other people doesn't care about. And you get these faces, right? And they're important for the story of this comic. Like, it's funny to talk about the funny faces he makes. And some of his panels are some of the best ever. Like, the classic, the most infamous Kevin Maguire is the Batman's One Punch. Guy Gardner takes off his Green Lantern ring, sets it down, and says, Batman, I bet I could beat you in a fight without my ring. And Batman clocks him in one punch. And yeah. The scene is funny, which is, we're talking again about the marriage between the two, but what really activates the scene is Batman, who never smiles, has the slightest hint of a smirk, and likewise, Guy Gardner's face while he's getting knocked the fuck out is perfect. It's flawless. It's that kind of face that you would freeze frame that nobody else draws. because they can't. But Kevin Maguire nails both of those in just the perfectly beautiful way. And that's important comic book storytelling, because if you can't draw that, you have to put it in a text box, and the reader has to read it, and it's not as effective. Or you have to put in a word bubble, or you have to put in these text hints that then you might as well have been reading a novel. What really makes comics is the activation of the text with the art together in a sequential way. And I mean, I know that's the definition of comics, but really, that page works because that's all that's on that page. That page works because Kevin Maguire draws it well enough that JMD Mateus doesn't have to put in a text box. Boom.
Boom. Done.
Done. Show finished.
Episode's done. Bye.
Is there anybody you guys wanted to talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Yes. Who did the art for We Three?
Quietly, I think.
Yeah, Frank Quietly.
I was browsing through this comic, and oh my god, there are a couple scenes that I feel like it's been a long time since we read this, but there's one where the cat is jumping through a series of panels, except the panels themselves are, they're like perpendicular to the plane that you're seeing. So you see the panels as like a representation of time, but the cat's going through them and you see him going between the panels because the panels aren't just flat. I don't even know how to describe this verbally, but it is so amazing. Or like the scene, there's another fight scene that's a full 2-page spread, I think. And it's just all these little tiny squares. A frame that shows simultaneous detail and then a larger action behind them. And Frank Quietly in this comic just defies how time operates in comics. Because usually, like, you know, panel A comes before panel B in sequence and in time. And, like, if one panel is longer, it implies a longer amount of time, or, and, like, we assume things happen between panels that we can't actually see, because it's not a movie. But here, it's like, he just takes all of that and throws it out the door, and shows the exact thing that is happening between the panels that we assume, or shows panels that don't indicate the passage of time. They're just simultaneous movement, and it's just so cool.
Yeah, Frank Quietly is one of those guys that I go back and forth with because, I mean, there's the marriage between the story and the art, and Frank Quietly works a lot with Grant Morrison, who's an artist, or who's an author that I don't really like because he writes weird shit. So then Frank Quietly tends to draw weird shit that I don't like. Like the X-Men run. I think that was Frank Quietly.
Yeah.
But every time that happens, he also does Multiversity, and the story in, this is actually a good example. I did not like the story of Multiversity. I didn't like almost any part of the story of Multiversity, but there's a 2-page spread that Frank Quietly does where it's the before and after of a murder scene and people walking through the murder scene, and the panels go back and forth between the before and after in a non-sequential kind of way. Just like what you're talking about, Jen, from We Three. And that 2-page spread is phenomenal piece of storytelling, completely activated and done by the art that you can't do otherwise. And likewise, another one of my favorite splash pages is the final page of All-Star Superman. All-Star Superman's a really good story, which is an exception to the rule for Grant Morrison, I think. But that last page is just beautiful. It's the page with him, like, on a giant gear, pulling a lever in the middle of the sun, and he's like incandescent, and it's all these different shades of yellow, and just the pose and lighting and everything is perfect in that, and that's just beautiful Frank Quietly art. Yeah, I go back and forth, but I go back and forth because he doesn't draw stories that I like, but you can't deny the quality of his art.
All right.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't think I agree with all of that, but okay.
Who? What about you, Dave? Is there anybody you you want to mention that we haven't put in there yet?
Let me see. No, I mean, I think I hit the high points. I know Frank Miller's a controversial person, but look at stuff like The Dark Knight Returns and Sin City and 300. Those are all, it's a very unique style. And like Alex Ross, when you see a Frank Miller piece, it's clearly Frank Miller.
Yeah, you know it.
So, yeah, I just want to say, you know, give a quick shout out to Frank Miller.
Yeah. Say the one I haven't mentioned yet, if I'm not dicking around, would probably be one that we just read at the beginning of this year, Declan Shalvey, who did the art for Moon Knight. I don't remember if we like the story of Moon Knight, but man, the non-verbal storytelling that Declan Shalvey can do during the fight scenes and stuff. Like, there's tricks that he has with the batons and his gadgets that I didn't think you could pull off on the page without having to explain it with text, but Declan Shalvey can do it. I don't know how else to explain it. Like, there's like one of his batons breaks and he uses like a thing in it to pop out and knock a guy out. I don't even remember the exact scene, but I just remember being floored by how good this guy's acting in an action scene was. And especially because I'd never heard of him before. He's great. But then if I'm gonna dick around, I'd say that you need to go look up Adriano Batista, Frank Cho, Adam Hughes, and Terry Dodson for obvious Andy-related reasons. You need to go look those four up.
Yeah, you're definitely a Frank Cho fan. I mean, I think Frank Cho does great.
Oh, God, sorry, I had to cough.
Sure you did.
So I don't know. I think we've covered a decent primer. I think more than anything, we just sat around and talked about comic book art that we liked. But I mean, if you're not used to sitting around talking about comic book art, hopefully you can kind of pick up on some of the language we used or how we talked about it, what we appreciated. I don't know. Was this helpful? Do you think this would be helpful for people?
I hope so.
I know we just wasted an hour and a half on it. I hope it was helpful. But listeners, if you found this helpful, if you thought it was neat, go ahead and let us know. You can tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/welcometocomics. You can go to welcometocomics.com. On the left, there's a button that says contact. There's a little form filled out. I'll send an email to my personal inbox, so I will definitely get it. Or if you're a patron, you can send us a message on Patreon. patreon.com/welcometocomics. That's the thing. Yep. Go there, become a patron, support the show. Right now, we get just enough to cover our bandwidth and our web hosting, which is great. Believe me, guys, I'm so thankful for all of the patrons that we have. Because without them, I would still be doing this, but I have to pay out of my own pocket, and we might not still be doing it in a more couple of years. But with the patron support, I can keep doing this more and more and more. So go be a patron today. You can support the show, help keep the lights on. And beyond that, we have some goals for stuff that we can do when we get some more money coming in, things that require more bandwidth or more technical production. So that's it for the art. Next week, we're going to get back to talking about comic book stuff. I don't know how to transition to this. Next week, we're going to start our Gundam series, because it's September, and the due date for our Super Welcome to Sugoi Comics Mega Gundam Throwdown, I think that was the name of the competition, will be up on Facebook. So give it another week. We'll all take pictures of our Gundams, put them up on Facebook, and it's going to be so sick. You get to go and vote. It's a blind competition, so we're not going to tell you who is whose Gundam, but just go like the one that you like. We'll put more details up on the website. We'll let you know more next week. Next week, though, we're going to start out by reading Mobile Suit Gundam, The Origin, Volume 1, Activation, by David.
Oh, geez,
you're going to have to help me.
I wasn't ready for that. Yoshikazu Yasuhiko.
Yes. So that's a manga that we're going to read. Did Gundam start out in manga, or did it start out in anime?
That's a good question.
I don't know.
Turn in next week for the answer to that question.
Either way, I did a bunch of research on where to start. Mobile Suit Gundam The Origin is not the best Gundam thing to read, but it's a good place to start if you've never read or watched anything Gundam, which is me. I've never watched or read anything Gundam. After that, we're going to watch Mobile Suit Gundam Unicorn, which is an OVA. What does OVA even stand for? I don't even know. People talk about OVA.
Original Video Animation.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So that's the Mobile Suit Gundam Unicorn OVA. We're going to watch that one because somebody is building Banshee Norn. And Banshee Norn is featured in that 7-episode OVA. After that, we're going to watch Gundam Build Fighters, episodes 1 to 6, because it features Zaku Amazing. And then we're going to wrap up our Gundam series by watching Gundam Build Fighters try episodes 19 to 25, which is the end of the series. If you want to, it'd probably be better if you watched all 25 episodes. They're probably pretty good. They go pretty quick. David's been talking about how good they are.
I really liked Gundam Build Fighters. I watched both series over like a month, and they were really good.
And they're both really popular. If you go on Gundam subreddits and stuff, they're both really, really popular. So episodes 19 to 25, we're going to watch those specifically. But if you got time, watch them all. Why not?
It's worth it. They're really fun animes. And they're short. Only 25 episodes.
So that's what we have coming up next week. Mobile Suit Gundam The Origin Volume 1 Activation by Yoshikazu Yasuhiko. And until
See,
then,
you can
everybody.
Do it, Andy.
Yeah, I know. If I don't think too hard.
Don't get scared. It's just a name.
There's so many letters in that name, though.
Your name has a lot, too.
That's true.
Imagine being a Japanese person trying to say Vigon. It has like 8 vowels in it.
So many places to go wrong. That's next week. Until then, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye.